I want to start today with a bit of a riddle.
Oh, okay. I'm intrigued.
Or maybe a test of your literary knowledge. I'm going to read you a quote, and you just tell me what kind of book you think it's from. Ready?
I am born ready. Let's hear it.
Okay, so listen closely to the adjectives here.
Yeah.
There exists a lovely pair of crystals that evolve hand in hand with an intimacy that is alluring and iridescent.
Wow.
Goes on. They complement each other in more ways than one. It is as if they were made for each other.
That is shockingly steamy,
Right.
alluring and iridescent intimacy. I mean, if that's not from, I don't know, a Victorian romance novel, I don't know what is.
It sounds exactly like it, but plot twist. That is actually the opening paragraph to a metallurgy textbook.
No.
Yes. Specifically, the preface to the 2024 edition of Perlite in Steels.
Metallurgy, of course. The romance of the iron carbon phase diagram, I should have known.
And that lovely pair isn't, a couple of star-crossed lovers. It's two microscopic crystals that form something called perlite.
Which, to be fair to the author, is arguably a more important union than any literary romance.
How so?
We are talking about the material backbone of the modern world here.
Exactly. And that is our mission for this deep dive. We're going to unpack this preface to understand how two materials, which, spoiler alert, are actually kind of terrible on their own,
Right.
manage to evolve hand in hand to become one of the strongest mass-produced microstructures on the planet.
It's a fascinating paradox. You have one component that's soft and another that is notoriously brittle, but you put them together in this specific, intimate way.
And they hold up the world.
Literally.
And we do mean that literally. We're talking about the stuff that supports the longest suspension bridges, keeps high-speed trains on the tracks, and get this, it prevents skyscrapers from toppling over during earthquakes.
It's the infrastructure of the modern world, just hidden in plain sight.
Yet our guide through all this is the source material itself, written by Professor HKDH Padatia. And this isn't just any metallurgist.
Yeah.
The guy is a night bachelor.
A literal knight of the realm writing about steel? It feels stylistically consistent.
It really does. So, okay, let's strip away the poetry for a second and get into the physics.
Right.
Who exactly is this power couple?
So perlite isn't one thing, it's a composite structure. It forms when austenite, that's the high temperature phase of steel, transforms into two distinct phases at the same time.
And those are
Ferrite and cementite.
ferrite and cementite. Okay, let's break those down. Let's start with the one that sounds like construction material, cementite.
Right, cementite or iron carbide. Let's call it the problem child of the relationship.
Problem child.
By definition, cementite is brittle.
And how brittle are we talking?
Extremely. So in material science, for something to bend, the atoms need to slide past each other. We call those slip systems.
Right.
Cementite has this really complex crystal structure, and it effectively has no easy slip systems.
So stubborn.
Incredibly stubborn. It doesn't want to bend. It just wants to break.
Is this just, theoretical, or have we actually tested it?
Oh, it's been tested. The text references a great experiment by Umemoto's team at Toyohashi University. They actually managed to make big bulk samples of pure cementite.
Just a big chunk of the hard stuff.
Exactly. And when they tested it at room temperature, it did what the physics
This
predicted.
broke.
It snapped. It shattered. It has basically zero ductility on its own. It behaves more like a ceramic plate than a piece of metal.
Okay, so if I'm an engineer designing a bridge and you hand me a material that shatters, I'm probably going to fire you. Why do we want that in our infrastructure?
That is the aha moment. This is where the intimacy comes in.
Okay.
When that same brittle cementite is cosseted, that's the word Padatia uses, which I love. When it's tucked inside the perlite structure, its entire personality changes.
Cosseted. That makes it sound like it's being hugged.
In a way, it is. It's surrounded by the soft, ductile ferrite. And because it's locked inside this composite, it's constrained. It can't just shatter.
There's nowhere for the cracks to go.
Exactly. So inside the perlite, that brittle cementite can tolerate huge plastic strains. It bends without breaking.
So it's forced to act against its own nature to support the load.
It goes even further. Under extreme stress, like when you're drawing steel into a fine wire, the cementite eventually loses the will to exist.
That is surprisingly emotional for metallurgy. What does that mean physically?
It means the mechanical energy is so great that it forces the carbon atoms out of the cementite and into the ferrite. The crystal structure literally sacrifices itself.
It dissolves.
It dissolves into the ferrite to accommodate the deformation and stop the whole thing from failing.
So the ferrite, which normally hates having that much carbon, is forced to just accept it.
Yes, It's a complete transformation of properties just based on the arrangement.
Okay, so let's talk about that arrangement. When I pictured perlite before, I always imagined, you know, a layer cake, a layer of ferrite, a layer of cementite, like zebra stripes.
And that's exactly how it's taught in a lot of introductory textbooks. The word often used is lamellar, which comes from a description of mica from like 230 years ago.
So just simple plates side by side.
Right. But Professor Badashia points out that this is a huge oversimplification. He says, assuming they're just plates is untenable.
So what is it really?
A perlite colony is actually a bicrystal.
A bicrystal?
Yeah. Think of it less like a stack of paper and more like two skeletons that have grown into each other. It's an interpenetrating, convoluted structure.
Like a 3D puzzle.
Exactly. If you were to somehow dissolve all the ferrite away, the cementite wouldn't just fall apart into little plates.
It would still be standing.
It would stand there as a self-supporting, sponge-like skeleton.
And why does that distinction matter? Is it just semantics?
No, it's critical for toughness. If it were just independent plates, you could peel them apart.
Like flaky pastry.
Right. But because they are woven together in this complex 3D maze, a crack can't just zip through a straight line. It has to navigate the maze that gives it resilience.
Okay, so we've got this convoluted bicrystal structure. That's the sheep of the strength. But what about size? Does size matter here?
Oh, absolutely. This brings us to one of the most fundamental rules in material science, which the text says reigns supreme.
And that is?
The Hall-Petch relationship.
Hall-Petch. Sounds like a law firm.
It does, doesn't it? But it's a lot of physics. And it basically says the finer the structure, so the closer the spacing between those bits of ferrite and cementite, the stronger the material becomes.
So we want it tight.
Very tight. I mean, let's look at the scale. Scientists have made artificial perlite by just stacking foils of iron and carbon.
Okay.
The spacing there is coarse.
Yeah.
About 400 micrometers.
Which is huge in the world of metallurgy.
It's huge, yeah. The coarsest ever recorded. But now look at commercial steel, the stuff we actually use. The typical spacing is about 0.2 micrometers.
Wow. So thousands of times smaller.
Exactly. And we can go even smaller. If you get perlite to form under a high magnetic field, we're talking 30 Tesla, a monster field.
Yeah.
You can get the spacing down to 0.05 micrometers.
0.05. That's incredibly tiny. And according to this Hall-Petch rule, that means it's incredibly strong.
Incredibly. So we measure tensile strength in pascals. A standard structural steel might be a few hundred megapascals.
Right.
But high-end perlite, strength exceeding 3 gigapascals, that's 3 billion pascals, is used routinely.
Routinely.
Routinely and theoretically. We've seen strength approaching 7 GPa.
7 billion pascals. That sounds like sci-fi material. Why aren't we building everything out of that?
Well, there's always a trade-off, right?
Yeah.
The text notes that the 7 GPa sample is unlikely to see the light of day in mass production.
Why not?
To get it that strong, the sample has to be tiny and undergo significant trauma, severe deformation. It becomes incredibly strong, but it probably loses its ductility.
So it might support a planet, but it might also snap if you hit it with a hammer.
Pretty much. Still, 3 GPa is nothing to sneeze at.
Right. So let's ground this. Where are we actually seeing this superhero material in our daily lives? You mentioned bridges.
Bridges are a huge one, specifically suspension bridges. Okay.
The steel ropes that support the world's largest single-span bridges. Those are based entirely on perlite.
That's oddly comforting to know, but it gets better, right? You mentioned skyscrapers.
It gets much better. You know those massive skyscrapers that have to survive high winds and earthquakes?
Yeah.
They often have these things called tuned mass dampers, basically giant counterweights hanging inside the building to stop it from swaying.
And let me guess.
What do you think holds those massive weights up? Perlite ropes.
Of course.
And Padacia makes this really poignant observation. He reminds us that Earth is the only planet in the solar system with colliding crustal plates.
We live on a jittery planet.
Tectonic perturbations, as he calls them. And without materials like perlite that can handle that kind of stress, our modern skyline just couldn't exist.
That puts a whole new perspective on city living. But there was another application that surprised me even more. Tires.
Yes. This is a classic example of hidden engineering.
I just assumed tires were rubber, maybe some nylon. They are mostly rubber, but rubber is floppy. It needs a skeleton to hold its shape. That skeleton is made of steel cords.
And those cords are perlitic.
They are.
Why perlite specifically? Is it just the strength?
Strength is part of it, but there's a chemical reason too. It turns out perlite helps create a hermetic seal at the rim.
So it keeps the air in.
It keeps the air in, and it bonds exceptionally well with the rubber. It's that interface where the steel meets the rubber that's critical for safety. If that bond fails, the tire blows.
So every time I'm on the highway, Perlite is keeping me alive.
Quite literally.
Now, I want to ask about trains, because trains feel like the classic steel application, but the text makes a distinction here.
It does. It distinguishes between structural steels, like for ships or buildings, and rail steel.
What's the difference?
It comes down to welding versus wear. Structural steels need to be welded easily and quickly, so they usually use a mix of ferrite and perlite, a bit softer but easier to join.
Okay, that makes sense.
But high-speed rail, the Shinkansen in Japan running at 300 kilometers per hour, that rail takes a beating. It needs that pure hard strength.
So those rails are fully perlitic.
Fully perlitic.
But didn't you just say that pure perlite is hard to weld?
It is. The text says joining these perlitic rails requires bizarre methods.
Bizarre methods. I love that phrasing in a technical text.
It implies a level of difficulty and specialized technique that goes way beyond standard manufacturing.
So they accept the headache of these bizarre methods
Yeah.
because the performance is non-negotiable.
Precisely. For a building, you can compromise a little on strength to build it faster. For a high-speed train, you can't.
That's fascinating. Okay, I want to pivot to something the text calls the science of chaos.
Right.
Because for something so structured, apparently the science behind how it forms is messy.
A mess is the direct quote.
Why is it a mess? We've been using steel for centuries.
We have, but the theory is tricky because real-world steel isn't pure. It's an alloy. We add things like manganese, silicon, chromium to tweak the properties.
The ingredients.
Well, those ingredients, those substitutional solutes, they don't respect the rules. They don't follow the equilibrium maps we expect.
The atoms are rebelling.
Effectively. The text mentions para-equilibrium, which is a state metallurgists sometimes use as a model. But Padishi argues that for perlite, it shouldn't even be regarded as an appropriate state
Why not?
because the iron atoms, carbon atoms, and alloy atoms are all moving at different speeds. The standard maps just don't capture the chaos of what's actually happening at the atomic level.
So it sounds like we know how to make it work, but the why is still slipping through our fingers a bit.
That's often the case. But what's even crazier is what happens when you introduce violence to the system.
Violence, like shooting it.
Exactly like shooting it, high velocity impact.
Okay, what happens when you shoot perlite?
Weird things. You can get these things called adiabatic shear bands.
Which are?
They're bands of intense deformation that seem to completely ignore the microstructure. It's like the impact cuts right through the logic of the crystal.
It just ignores the
It
rules.
ignores the rules. And then there's a phenomenon called spalling.
Spalling. That sounds painful.
It is for the metal. Imagine an impact hitting the steel so fast that the shockwave is moving faster than the speed of sound within the metal itself.
Wait, the speed of sound inside the metal, that's what, like 5,000 meters per second?
Exactly. Sound is information. It's a wave telling the atoms what's happening. If the impact is faster than that wave can travel, the material can't communicate the stress.
So it didn't get the memo.
It didn't get the memo. So instead of bending, it just shatters internally. It tears itself apart because the information couldn't travel fast enough to tell the crystal to react.
That's mind-blowing.
It is. And you know, speaking of history, we should give a nod to a scientist named Bellew back in 1922.
The grandfather of perlite studies.
In a way, he was the first to really study the stereometry of the perlite grain. He realized you can't just look at one slice.
The 3D structure.
Right. And he drew one of the first phase diagrams showing these boundaries. The text mentions his diagram is sometimes called the Hultgren extrapolation today.
Unfairly, it says.
Yes. Padishian makes a point to say it's unfairly called that. He wants Bellew to get his credit. It's
Yeah.
a nice little nod.
Justice for Bellew.
Justice for Bellew.
So we've covered the structure, the strength, the applications. But as we wrap up, the text makes it clear we haven't solved everything.
Not even close. Padishia ends with some really provocative questions that show we're just scratching the surface.
Like what?
Well, he asks why we see these eutectoids, the reaction that creates perlite in some systems but not others. Like, why are they absent in the solid state of the argon nitrogen system?
I mean, that is a question I have definitely never asked myself.
It sounds esoteric, but it's fundamental. If we don't know why it doesn't happen there, do we really understand why it does happen in steel?
That's a great point. What else?
The one that really stuck with me was about the possibility of a thruple.
A thruple.
Perlite is a pair, right? Ferrite and cementite, two phases growing together. Hideshia asks, is there a eutectoid that evolves with more than two product phases? Could there be a trio?
The ternary perlite, a thruple of crystals.
Exactly. Imagine three different crystals all woven together in that same intimate structure.
If two crystals give us three GPA strength and let us build skyscrapers, what would three give us?
That is the billion-dollar question. It implies there might be super perlites hiding in the periodic table that we just haven't found.
It really circles back to that lovely pair quote we started with. We have this one pairing, ferrite and cementite, that has let us build the modern world.
A marriage of opposites, the brittle and the soft, combining to create resilience. It's a beautiful metaphor.
It is. And Professor Padishia's stated goal with this preface was to titillate the imagination.
I'd say he succeeded. It stops being a textbook and becomes a challenge to the future.
I think so, too. And that's the thought I want to leave you with. We can manipulate crystals at the 0.05 micrometer level to hold up skyscrapers. But if there are still unanswered questions, if we don't even know if a three-phase version exists, what else is out there?
What other lovely pairs or trios are waiting in the math, just waiting for the right introduction to change engineering forever?
Exactly. Thanks for diving deep with us today.
Always a pleasure.